This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Payal Arora and Usha Raman. Payal Arora is a digital anthropologist and author of award-winning books, including The Next Billion Users with Harvard Press. Her expertise lies in digital cultures, inequality, and inclusive design. She's a professor and chair in technology, values, and global media cultures at Erasmus University, Rotterdam, and co-founder of FemLab, a future of work initiative. Usha Raman is a professor in the Department of Communication, University of Hyderabad. Her research and teaching span the areas of journalism pedagogy, critical studies of science, health and technology, feminist media studies, and digital cultures. She was elected Vice President of International Association for Media and Communication Research for the period 2020 to 24. She's a co-founder of FemLab, an IDRC-funded initiative on feminist futures of work. Today, we are going to be discussing their co-edited book, Feminist Futures of Work, Reimagining Labor in the Digital Economy. The book is co-edited along with Renny Koenig, who unfortunately couldn't make it today, and it has been published by the Amsterdam University Press in 2023. Payal and Arora, welcome to NBN, and thank you so much for giving me your valuable time.
Thank you so much for having us on board.
Hi everyone, and thank you, Rituparna.
Right. So let me begin by asking, you know, what was your main motivation behind putting this book together?
Yeah. So we're very excited about this book. And but, you know, behind every book, there's always a story. And our story is that it was funded by IDRC. So it was a very exciting time in 2020. And where Usha and I received this grant from a Canadian grant agency that was focusing on the future of work in the global south. And we had pitched a project on how, low-income women workers and other marginalized groups were using the new digital technologies that were coming to play and how they were shifting the nature of work and possibly helping them organize themselves digitally, collectively, and, you know, improve their work conditions. So much of our work was meant to be, and the field sites in Bangladesh and India. And our vision was to come up with a book at the end of the project. But the way this played out was that at the start, we all were homebound because of the pandemic. And many of our team members were stuck in different sites. So there was a dual purpose, is we realized we needed to create a culture, a work culture, a sort of a team building culture across borders nationally, as well as within, right, in India, because people were spread across. And also to be able to connect with different stakeholders, because our approach was not just to capture the voices of women workers from below, but also the different people within organizations and institutions in the public and private sector that could be, in partnership, shape the future of work by addressing these concerns from their, you know, workers. So we started by actually getting Renny Koenig on board, who is a digital sociologist, as you mentioned, but also he was managing our blog. And we thought, let's have a blog space to just, you know, get our thoughts, get to have an opinion about what was going on, have conversations, not just with the world outside, with each other, but also to be able to get to know and figure these things out in a virtual context. And so that's something that happened in a very humble way, in a sort of a monthly way. And Usha, Renee, and I were just editing it and putting it out there. And then it became a thing. It became a thing because people were interested in it, people were engaged with it, and then we were getting a number of actors from the public and private sector interested in contributing to this. And at some point, the three of us looked at it and thought, this is a really rich set of blogs that should be built into something bigger. And so we decided to invite them to contribute to a book and expand on their ideas. And we're very happy with the way in which this played out, because you would see, as you can see, firstly, it's extremely interdisciplinary, but also it cuts across sectors and it's got very different writing styles. And the most importantly, it's meant to not just, you know, speak to academic audiences. It's meant to be for any kind of lay people who are very interested in this area. And I hope we've accomplished that.
Right. Thank you for that response. You know, so I also wanted to ask, how do you think the book becomes both global and interdisciplinary in character?
The interdisciplinary character of this book actually started with firstly the three of us, right? Usha is a feminist media scholar. I'm a digital anthropologist. Renee is a sociologist. But also we partnered with an organization called Justice Adda, which is a design and legal firm. So you have legal scholars as well as designers on board. So already the core team is very interdisciplinary. But when we reached out to people across board, we have urban planners, we have a number of also outside of the disciplines. So I think I would add another layer. It was intersectoral. And what I mean by that is it cuts across people doing work in very different sectors, from construction to salon services to artisanal services, which means that they have different vocabularies, understandings of the ways of work and policy work. And so I think that was really exciting because they had to keep their jargon outside the door and really engage with one another, because you were really interested in seeing what cuts across these sectors. And in terms of global, I must say, it speaks to a larger trend in academia where there's a pushback that when it is a context which is not an Anglo-Saxon context, then we always have to preface it, or we have to bracket it as in India, in Bangladesh. And it's as if that kind of context is relevant for only those people either living there or are studying it, versus if it's in the Anglo-Saxon context, it is by default a global, universalistic, or normative sort of knowledge making, right? And so that's something that the three of us, Usha, Renee, and I, have been really attentive to, because the notion is that we need to inform, educate and bring awareness on the future of work, particularly in contexts like, India and Bangladesh, amongst marginalized communities, because that is the radical normative. That is the majority of the world. And when we look at these contexts, they are highly repurposable to the rest of the world. So we're really flipping the pyramid here.
Right. So please also talk a little bit about the context in which the book is located.
So maybe I can jump in here. In some senses, Payal has already described the context, but just to flesh it out a little bit more, when we started the project, we were looking at 5 sites of informal work across India and Bangladesh. And the sites were a garment sector, sanitation, construction, home-based artisanal work, and also platform-based salon work. And the reason we chose these sectors is because there was a very high degree of informality on the one hand, and also large numbers of women engaging in these sectors in an informal capacity. So that was the context of the project. But as Payal mentioned, COVID struck, and we had to really rethink our fieldwork. And everything moved online. So in that process, we discovered that there was also other areas where women were engaging, but we had not considered earlier, for instance, the ride-hailing sector. So that was another area where we felt there was a lot of learning to be had, because companies like Ola in India and Uber were increasingly hiring women. And at the same time, we found that the garment sector was difficult to study during the pandemic because things had almost ground to a halt in Bangladesh with access becoming very difficult to garment workers. So that was the project context. And as we sort of debated these issues online and started reflecting on them through the blogs, we found that other people in other countries were also engaging with similar questions from different perspectives. So for instance, in South Africa, we had people talking about youth-led initiatives around work. We had people in Latin America talking about issues related to informal economy. So the context, I would say, is varied, both in terms of the origin of the book as well as in terms of the content that we ultimately ended up sourcing. So that's in terms of the research context as well as the content, you know, where the content came from. Yeah.
Right. So how important is the COVID-19 pandemic to the story of your book?
Well, again, I think anyone who started work in 2020 cannot escape the pandemic, right? So if your work involved people in any way, in any space, then COVID was certainly a factor to consider. So I think Payal already spoke to this, to the fact that, you know, our field work had to be really reimagined because that entire first year, 2020, March onwards, through a large part of 2021, we couldn't really organize the kind of field engagement that we had planned. So we had thought about doing focus groups in the sites where women were working, in their communities. So that became difficult to do. Instead, we had to do in-depth interviews, doing a lot of our outreach online. So that definitely affected the way we reached communities and engaged with them. But talking about the book more specifically and not just our project, I think COVID, in fact, was in a strange way something that brought a community together. So what the book represents, and I think that's certainly a call out of, you know, the pivot to the online during COVID, what the book ended up, or what our blog ended up doing was bringing together a community of people engaging with these issues. So COVID affected our fieldwork negatively in some sense, but positively in terms of building this community that produced the book.
So could you also talk about the way in which the book is organized or structured?
Yeah, maybe I can chime in here. So, you know, we organize a book along four dimensions, design, governance, networks, and vision. And part of the reason is that we looked and mapped the kinds of blogs already, which were part of our, you know, two-year sort of corpus. And we reorganized the players and the stakeholders in these dimensions. And we realized it made some really interesting categories. So, for example, the first category of design, we engaged with people from Meesho, like basically there's a lot of platform services, right? Ola Mobility Institute, and, you know, Urban Company, a lot of these gig companies which were catering to salon services, to ride hailing and reselling, and the role of women and how they were gaining mobility, how they were gaining some kind of forms of dignity at workplace, building their organizing capabilities, but also their concerns and challenges. And it was very interesting to see this being captured by people from academia, like to people who are working in the industry, and you have both contributing to the design section. The second part is the governance section, which was because the design part was really about putting the platforms at the center, right? And the governance was really putting, you know, the people at the center, the workers, and their relationship with one another and the extent to which they can organize themselves in a way that can create a critical mass, can do a pushback, as well as the digital networks that could actually, come out of this. And so we focused on artisanal economies and the collectivizations in Bangladesh. For example, we had Web Foundation talk about digital connectivity and participation of women. Also, it was very interesting about the urban relocation. So the sort of notion of like connecting the physical and the digital of, you know, how what happens when you relocate people. So that was really about networks of which were at once digital as well as social. And that traveled well into the network section. Now, the difference between the governance and the networks is really that the governance is more about the relationship building so they can institute change. And with networks, it was really about the storytelling, the sort of implicit ideologies behind it. For example, we have Justice Ada contributing to that in terms of representation and action. About shadow economies. And also one of the biggest challenges is how do you build stakeholder communities from below? And that was also something that we focused on in the network section. And the and last was about the vision, because, you know, while you have these thoughts about what's happening with automation, and it could be, and it tends to be very binary in thinking that it's either going to replace human work, or it is going to, you know, create enormous amounts of opportunity. And so there's oftentimes like, you know, dystopic and utopic visions. And we were trying to break away from these binaries in a sort of true feminist fashion by showing the coexistence of, you know, contradiction and tension, but also opportunity. And we tried to do that with portraying futures which are beyond the binary. And that was the section of vision. So that was how we actually organized our book, and hopefully that serves as a nice guidance to this kind of work, I hope, in the future.
Right. So how do you think we can understand experiences of work from a feminist perspective in the Global South? It's a very broad question, but if you could talk about a few examples from the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, and let's take the, you know, part of the design section, right? There is some interesting work from the ride hailing sector, and the was that there's a huge demand for women taxi drivers, and yet there's a limited supply. It's an extraordinarily limited supply because women's movement in public space has always been, you know, watched closely, because you know, you are in oftentimes patriarchal societies where the public nature of movement is very gendered. And so this has implications on certain kinds of work, which demands interacting with strangers and moving in public spaces like the ride-hailing sector. But what we found, so there's that feminist perspective when we put women workers at the center here, is that what is it that they want? What does it take to get them on board? Because after all, women customers also, and other constituents that are actually going to benefit from women as drivers, for example, children, where a lot of parents felt safer having their children travel with women drivers, for example. But the feminist perspective was like, the interesting insights was that they oftentimes felt that one of the big hurdles was there's not sufficient number of toilets that were accessible as they were driving, and clean and quality toilets which were safe, right? So there was also that they are meant to do care work and also household work. So they have to be able to decline, you know, certain kinds of decline calls and decline certain opportunities, and they get punished algorithmically for that. So we have to see that it's not, basically on the equal level playing field here. And these are some of the challenges for the ride-hailing sector. And I think Usha can speak to maybe the sanitation sector and others, which she also was a part of.
Yeah, thanks, Pan. So, you know, I think one of the primary drivers of our work and something that I think should inform both policy and its implementation at various levels is that when we're talking about women and work, we need to be informed not from an economic or, you know, an industry level aspiration, but we need to be informed by how women's lives unfold on the ground. And this is across sectors. But getting more particular about it, or more specific about it, as Pai said, in the ride-hailing sector, there are very specific dynamics that construct or constrain women's work. Similarly, in each of the other sectors, we found that there were very specific constraints. So when we're talking about sanitation, for instance, typically sanitation work is contracted by the government. But what is happening increasingly, particularly in large metro cities, is that it's being further subcontracted to private players. And there is an opportunity for women here and also a danger, right? Because private sector in areas like sanitation is very poorly regulated. So that presents certain vulnerabilities to women. But at the same time, private sanitation players are introducing technology into areas that women can possibly take advantage of. So we found, like in Hyderabad, there are new companies that are entering the sanitation space that work in waste handling and waste sorting. And these are occupations that used to be heavily caste-based. And they carried a stigma. But now when they're moving into the private sector, they're introducing technological tools to actually sort, to label, and to repackage waste for further processing. And these are tasks that are happening within large factory-type spaces, which offer shelter and a greater level of security than for women particularly, than working on the street in the usual ways we think about sanitation. So, but even here, there are dynamics that one needs to pay attention to. So for instance, which women get access to training in relation to these technologies? You know, what sort of base level do women start out at? So these are things that we're discovering that are happening in sectors that were traditionally dominated by certain caste dynamics, and privatizing in this sense has helped women. So that is in terms of sanitation. And when we look at artisanal work, just to give you one more example, we find that artisanal work that is done in the home has to happen within the woman's life world, right? So she has to organize her home in a way that accommodates the artisanal work. She has to organize her time in that way. But these are dynamics that the market often doesn't account for when they're either pricing a product or thinking about wages or thinking about occupational safety even. So what a feminist viewpoint would do is to then ask, where does a woman work and what does she need in that place of work when it is not a factory, when it is not an office? And then those concerns need to be brought into thinking about regulation and policy from a feminist standpoint.
Right. So what are some of the specific material and effective conditions of work that women do?
I think, you know, Payal, if I can take this on. Yeah. So I think, again, everything we've been saying speaks to exactly that, right? So you cannot form policy at higher levels without paying attention to the material conditions in which women work. So let's take the, you know, the case of platform work. And specifically beauty work on platforms. And one of the rich areas of engagement that we had was with salon workers who work for platform-based companies like Urban Company. And the promise of these platforms has been that it professionalizes work that has otherwise not been deemed professional. And to some extent, that is true. But then when you examine the actual material conditions of work, what happens is that these women are carrying out the work within domestic spaces, which are not their own. And these spaces are not really regulated, right? So a woman, a young woman who works for a Robin company gets allocated a client, and then she goes to this place, which may be in a remote area, she goes into this home. All kinds of dynamics operate within the home. There are gender dynamics, there are caste dynamics. And these are very often things that are not really accounted for in the way tasks are allocated or in the training that these young women undergo. So we need to understand, you know, what are the spaces in which women work? How does the algorithm distance them actually from the company when these platforms are designed? And how does the material then need to be put back into the design of the platform so that women not only have opportunities, but also have safeguards when they're dealing with clientele? So that's one example in terms of the material conditions. And of course, you know, when we talk about affective conditions, and this goes to speak for women's work across sectors, both on platforms and out of platforms, the notion that there is an unpaid element of care that usually is layered over many jobs that women do, whether it is in beauty work or, as Payal mentioned, you know, you work as a driver. You're expected to have that layer of politeness, of caring, which is certainly not valued economically, even though it's valued socially. So I think these are some of the concerns that come up when we talk about material and affective conditions.
Right. So my next question is actually about how design, be it of technology, spaces, or environments, create more favorable conditions on the supply side of labor that can encourage women not only to enter the workforce, but of course, remain within it.
Yeah, so let's build on what Usha just shared, actually, because it's a nice segue, is, for example, the case that she brought up about Urban Company. A good case in point is that a number of, when you read the chapters, a very rich chapter on the women workers and engagements at these spaces that are not their own. One of the requests and pushbacks is that these workers would appreciate to be able to rate customers too. So it's a two-way process because there's so much emphasis on quality management for the customer, but not so much for the workers themselves in terms of safety, in terms of rudeness, in terms of respect. And there should be a sort of a critical mass of comments that if it's geared towards a particular client, then the client is blocked from using that service. So there has to be repercussions. And this we found cuts across sectors, is that these can be really productive design elements algorithmically, as well as, you know, also in terms of organizationally, right? That means companies have to be invested in their workers and care about what their workers' conditions are and who they want to engage with. So this is also with the ride-hailing sector, where they should be able to rate customers that were inappropriate, were misogynistic, who were, you know, making moves on them in the night, etc. And if there are a number of comments, it has to be recorded, then they should not be able to use these platforms for a given period of time. And of course, there should be redressal mechanisms for both customers and workers. But so this is, whether it's in the salon services, whether it's in ride hailing, any kind of gig work platforms should have a sort of two-way process. So that's just one element. But on a more sort of a social level, right, say the construction sector, we noticed that, as Usha also brought up, is the number of spaces are deemed as work-related and others are not, even though a lot of women are engaged with these spaces which are not demarcated by the women themselves too. Like, for example, their own home in the case of artisanal workers, right? And so we need to reimagine what workspaces can be and broaden those environments. So in the case of the construction sector, oftentimes informally, women who are migrants, who have migrated with their husbands and their children, are at the construction site and are helping out. And I put that in quotes of helping out because they're actually laboring, but it is informal, it's often not recognized, and they're also taking care of their children. So one of the ways in which it could become more favorable is that there could be much more of a formal organizing of creches for their children, education, because oftentimes it has a sort of cascading effect. It impacts the education of their children and it creates higher inequalities in a sense in the long run because it's putting them back, right? It may put them ahead economically, but back socially for their children. So these are a number of ways in which we can start to think, not just for an individual, but for the family unit, for a sort of in terms of multiple kinds of plural identities, in terms of migrants, as we've seen, particularly with the pandemic, that they became some of the most vulnerable groups in India, but they were a formidable force to reckon with. And we realized that they were the underlying dynamic across sectors that kept these sectors alive. So not only do we need to recognize them, but also to create conditions which can actually give them due respect through formal arrangements, right? I think the last point I would say on this is about, say, for example, favorable conditions in the workplace in terms of upskilling, right? There needs to be spaces where they can grow, they can share ideas, whether it's digitally as well as physically in proximity, about how to improve their work conditions, how to improve their quality of work, also to see there's some sort of mobility for their own, prospects. And I think in these ways, I think it could really enable these workers to gain some meaningful employment. And I would say that would underline the sort of feminist approach to the way in which we looked at the future work here.
Okay. So how do you think feminist values allow us to reimagine a more inclusive and empathetic idea of work?
Well, actually, I think, what Payal just said pretty much sums it up, right? So when we talk about feminist values, we're not talking about something that is different just for women. But what we're hoping to say is that feminist values are at the core of how we need to think about work for everybody, women and people of other genders as well. If work is to be inclusive, if it is to be dignified, if it is to be meaningful, both for the worker and for the person who contracts the work. So we're not saying that, the pendulum swings so much the other way that we don't pay attention to productivity and profits. We recognize that those are important. But if you approach work from the point of view of the worker as being central, and thinking about that worker as a woman, because women workers tend to be, right at the bottom of the pyramid in terms of how they are valued and the attention that is paid to their well-being. So if you say that the last person in this value chain is the most vulnerable of women and attend to the needs of that person, then you find that the environment becomes better for everybody else. And I think this is a no-brainer, right? It is not... it's not something that we've discovered. It's something that a lot of feminist scholars have argued for in other spaces. So I would say that when we're talking about feminist values in relation to work, as we talked about feminist values in past years by in other forums, we talked about not separating the personal from the political. I think in relation to work, we have to start by not separating the professional from the personal, and recognizing that there's a politics in both those spheres, and we need to somehow integrate them through a fairer value system. So feminist values are about care, about dignity, about empathy, about meaningfulness of work, and all of these things.
Right. So last question. How do you understand FemWork and its contribution towards the future of work?
So, just our experience over the past 3 years and conversations with women, with advocates, with designers, with tech professionals, led us to believe that we needed to find a set of principles or parameters that could be applied both to policy and to spaces of implementation. And this is what we call the FemWork principles, right? They're simple principles, but possibly they will be complicated in their application. And this is something that we would invite people to engage with. So the principles we think will productively inform the design of contracts, the design of workplaces, and the design of platform interfaces. And just to run through the principles very briefly, they are, fairness, equity, mobility enhancing in terms of worker mobility. They're focused on the worker's identity. They provide opportunity for meaningful organization, respect-based, particularly for the worker, and knowledge-based. And when we say knowledge-based, we mean a constant attention to what we can learn from context, the context of work and the context of the worker. So those are the principles, and we think that they can be applied, in a variety of contexts. Maybe Payal would like to add something to that.
Yeah, actually, so just to add to that is that, we pioneered this term FemWork as a response to the trend of FemTech. So in the last few years, FemTech as a field has been celebrated as one of the big feminist approaches to the market at basically designing for women, by women kind of thing. And it's now like a $50 billion industry, right? And so there's a lot of enthusiasm about FemTech. But there's also this very neoliberal, marketized approach to it. And so we wanted to sort of decenter the tech, solutionism-oriented sort of approach to feminist futures of work and actually replace tech with work. Because after all, in today's digital economies and today's digital spaces, tech is work. And in a sense that as soon as whether we are engaging directly or indirectly, we are contributing data. And in that way, we are laboring. And that sort of broader perspective allows us to ask different kinds of questions from that framing of FemTech, right? So the three of us, Renee, Usha, and I, came up with this concept because we felt there was a need for another sort of framing to approach it, which is not just putting technology at the center. And we hope, to, as Usha said, use this as a way in which we can engage further with other people who are interested in feminist futures of work, which is not about putting the market at the center, not to say that that's not important, but it definitely has to be decentered from the well-being of the workers and their social, economic, but also, their broader well-being as a community.
Thank you so much, Payal and Usha, for giving us this time and talking about your book. I hope that our listeners now pick up a copy and get reading to it. So thank you once again for giving us your time.
Just to say to the listeners that it's an open access book. It can be freely downloaded. So just head over to Amsterdam University Press.
Yes, and thank you so much for this time.
Yes, you heard Usha. It's an open access book, so you can just download it and read it for free. Thank you.